tonight I'm talking about power in society. So we've been doing a series on power and talking about how we have power and how God gives us power. And last week we talked about power in the workplace, and this week we're going to talk about where we find power in society. So I graduated with a degree in communication and a degree in gender and women's studies. And a lot of people ask, like, what the heck is gender and women's studies? And actually, we talked a lot about power systems in my classes. So we talked about how power affects people. And specifically, it was kind of more in the scope of gender and looking at, like, sociology of gender and how power comes into play in society infecting mostly women. So I've thought a lot about these topics, and I'm pretty excited about just what I'm going to share with you guys tonight. It's kind of like a crash course in gender and women's studies, so sharing a couple nuggets just from what I enjoyed in my schooling. So after I graduated with a degree in communication and gender and women's studies, I had no idea what I was going to do with that, really no technical skills. And so I thought that I would spend my life or my livelihood or my job working for like a nonprofit. And so I was really excited to like just work for a nonprofit and care for, you know, the poor and just like, you know, spend my entire job just really caring for people in need. And that's kind of what I was super passionate about and excited about, and was just looking for a full-time job with a nonprofit when I first graduated. I ended up getting a part-time job at this nonprofit called Feed My Starving Children. I actually really hate the name. I, like, kind of despised the name and hated telling people that I worked for this place called Feed My Starving Children. My would be God, so it was a Christian organization, and we were there to feed his starving children. It was very, you know, blunt, and I kind of disagreed with the way that we were kind of characterizing the people we were helping in need, but it was very obvious. Like, we were literally helping children who were starving. So what it was a volunteer-based nonprofit where groups of volunteers would come in, and they would pack food, and then we would distribute it across the world. So usually to refugees or orphanages where literally kids were suffering from starvation and malnutrition. And the food that we were sending was like a special formula that helped people who were malnourished get healthier. And so it was like jam-packed with vitamins and nutrients, and groups of like 90 volunteers at a time would come. It was like groups of sixth graders, field trips, or like corporate organizations. And so for 2 hours I would work with 90 volunteers and help them pack food, and then we would box it all up, and eventually it would get shipped to like orphanages or refugee camps. And it was pretty fun, but also pretty crazy, because just like dealing with 90 volunteers and just a lot going on and having to worry about food and making sure people aren't putting their hands in the food. And anyway, it was kind of just like really labor intensive. I was like constantly cleaning. But at the end of those 2 hours, every volunteer group could say that they had fed like thousands of kids, because every pack that they made fed was provided 5 meals, and then multiplied how many packs they made over the course of 2 hours, you know, ended up being like, you fed 23,000 people in 2 hours, right? And so that was a really huge impact. But, you know, a lot of times helping the poor is not that easy. And that was one of the things that kind of frustrated me, because I was like, you know, it's really great that people can come and think that they're making a difference in 2 hours, and they are, but that's not where it stops, right? Like, that's not all it's about in caring for the poor. And so we're going to talk today about power in society, and ultimately how we can use that power to care for the people who are most vulnerable and who are poor, and then how we apply that in our everyday lives. So, thinking about power in society, we can first think about one place that's most obvious that we see power, and that's in institutions. So we all are part of multiple institutions. You guys can think of some of the most obvious ones: government, church, work, even family can be seen as an institution. And we're going to look to Andy Crouch to define an institution. So Andy Crouch wrote a book called Playing God, and we've been referencing that book throughout this series, and he has a lot of good thoughts about power and where we see power and how power is distributed, and just the biblical view of power. So I referenced that book as well, and he has a lot of good things to say about institutions and power. And he explains that institutions are made up of a couple things, and two of those are roles and rules. So what makes an institution is a set of rules and then a set of roles that people are in. So, for example, everyone has a role within an institution. We can think about football as an example. So football is an institution. It's a game where there's a set of rules in place, and then everyone plays a certain role in the game of football. And institutions have power because they have a set of rules in place and people in specific roles. And so institutions make it possible for people to flourish. And that's kind of the first thing. And if you think about it, within a role, you can only flourish when you're meeting your expectations of your role. So, for example, a football player, like a quarterback, is expected to be able to throw and people catch his passes, or a running back able to run the ball into the end zone. So thinking about how football players fulfill the expectations of their role, that allows them to flourish. And then it only makes sense within a set of rules, right? So because they can run to the end zone wouldn't matter unless the fact that, you know, that qualifies a touchdown based on the rules in place. So institutions allow power to be distributed because people are flourishing within certain rules and roles. But then you also can think about how power is given unequally to different people in specific roles. So, for example, in our workplace, we have executives or managers or bosses, and they have more of a certain power, right? And that's actually a good thing because they are able to distribute power in a way that's most efficient, and I guess allows people to flourish. So they have more power given to them, and that can be a good thing. But it is good for us to question, you know, should a few people have a lot of power in specific institutions? And we've talked about that, and that can lead to more of the dictatorship type of rule. So that can be dangerous when a few people have a lot of power within an institution. So one test is to ask, is everyone in the institution flourishing while these few people have power? So are these few people distributing power or using their power in a way that allows the whole community or whole institution to flourish? Or are they the only ones that are benefiting from their power or their access to that power. And so obviously we can think of a lot of examples where power is abused in those situations and institutions are broken. And institutions can perpetuate injustice because of idolatry. So we can think about how some people in, you know, that dictator type of institution are idolizing maybe power itself or the desire to control or, you know, they're playing God in a sense for over the other people in their lives in that institution, right? So that would be the case where, you know, injustice is being perpetuated within an institution. But institutions only have as much power as the people give them. So institutions are made up of individuals, and individuals are called to be to keep the institution accountable for using power in a way that makes sure everyone's flourishing. And the only way we can change institutions is by making new institutions. So basically changing the rules or creating new roles. And that allows us to change policies, practices, attitudes in place, basically create new culture and new institutions. So as individuals, part of institutions in society, we're called to change culture. And so then that leads us to more to think about our own individual power. And so we all have some power within these institutions, within our roles, as we're trying to fulfill our expectations within a set of rules. We oftentimes don't recognize the power we have. And Andy actually calls that privilege. So privilege can be defined as like invisible power. So we all have different privileges in society, and we may not realize that that's actually power given to us. At work, I went through a workshop that was called Unconscious Bias, and that's actually when we're unaware of the rules and roles that we perpetuate, right? So unaware of our privileges and unaware that maybe we're fulfilling specific roles within a set of rules. So that's a lot of academic talk. Give you a little bit of a basis of what we're thinking about. Institutions, individuals, bless you. So institutions are made up of individuals with power, and then each individual has privileges. So let's think about some of the institutions we see in society. We've already talked about work as one, but there's actually seven social identities that exist in society, and we all have all seven of these social identities. And these can be seen as institutions as well because they all have a set of rules and roles in place based on their own history. So these seven social institutions are gender, race, ethnicity, no particular order, sexuality, let's see, religion, what am I forgetting? Anyone got a guess?
Age,
yep, that's it. And the last
social
one's hard.
Economic status.
No, but those are good. I'll put them down. Class. So now we've got eight. The last one is actually able-bodied. I think, let's see. Class is kind of an exception because it can fluctuate, I think. Well, actually, some of these can too. So we'll keep that up there. So eight social identities or social institutions. And within each one, we have a majority and a minority within each category. And in all cases, the majority has more power or privilege. Yes?
Can you explain the difference between race and ethnicity?
Yes, good question. Does anyone want to take a stab at it? So, like, race, ethnicity is more like your national background. So, for example, being Swedish, but that being seen as a, under the category of white race. So, you know, like, yeah, more like ethnic. Race is...
genetic versus cultural.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it.
Race is a human construct made by people, and ethnicity is more
like... Yeah, ethnicity, though, like, can be, like, culturally defined, because obviously countries change, or, like, think about in Africa, there's, like, multiple different ethnic identities within one country. So, I guess... it can depend on the individual and also how they define it for themselves. But good question. So then the majority have privilege and power, and usually privilege or this power that they're unaware of. So, for example, like taking racism as an example, so racism is an institution of power, right? And so that's because... of a certain history in place, we have people are in certain roles and there are a set of rules in place, and people often are acting within their roles or fulfilling certain expectations. And although they aren't blatant or enforced, like we all know they are there. And so that kind of can cause an institution of racism and one that we would want to change. But as a depiction of privilege, so there's actually this really famous article about this white woman, Peggy McIntosh. She started to write a list of all the things that she realized she had privilege because of her race of being white. So things that she never really thought about as power before, but then once she started to list them out, she realized this is something that I take for granted, that I have power in society because of my race, and these are a few ways in which it plays out, even though I've never, like, kind of actively used that to my advantage, right? So I'll just list a few things that she listed out herself as ways that she saw she had privilege in society. So first one, if I should need to move, I can be pretty sure of renting or purchasing housing in an area which I can afford and which I would want to live. And I can be pretty sure that my neighbors in such a location will be neutral or pleasant to me. Whether I use checks, credit cards, or cash, I can count on my skin color not to work against the appearance of my financial reliability. I can swear or dress in secondhand clothes, or not answer letters without having people attribute these choices to the bad morals, the poverty, or the illiteracy of my race. I am never asked to speak for all the people of my racial group. I can take a job with an affirmative action employer without having coworkers on the job suspect that I got it because of race. So this actually was really powerful for me in one of my classes, just starting to think, like, where among these eight social categories do I have privilege? And I actually started writing them out just through my 4 years of college. I had a journal where I would... this came easy to me, and it might have been because of my race or because of my gender or because of my religion. And that actually is power in society. And at least recognizing it makes me able to take action on it. So we had defined power as, or rather authority, right? Power we defined as having authority and vulnerability. So authority being the ability to take meaningful action. And when you're aware of the power you have, you're able to then at least take action on it. So I would challenge you to think about your own privilege and what roles do you play in institutions and society. And how can you acknowledge the power that you have within these institutions? All right, so then we'll think about, now that we've thought about where we see power in society, we want to think about who is most vulnerable in our society. So Paul had asked you guys to think about some stories of where you see vulnerability in the workplace last week. Does anyone have any good stories to share where maybe they've seen people who are vulnerable in their workplace or in life, or possibly how they were an advocate for those who are vulnerable?
I have a lot of foreign coworkers where English is a second language, so sometimes it's not necessarily the work in itself with navigating things regarding just American culture, how to get things, or how. Mm-hmm. Like I had a coworker who got a speeding ticket for driving ridiculously fast in Arizona, and there's a whole issue of dealing with an attorney and then going to court and how to go through that process of being a foreign citizen. There's a disadvantage because he doesn't understand all the paperwork and all this different language, so it's kind of a very difficult spot to be in.
Yeah, that's good. That's a perfect example. Immigrants or, yeah, people who are outside of their culture.
Along the same lines, for example, patients who don't speak English, it's, you know, for the most part, try to get translators to do this, or you're supposed to do it. But I do find that, like, you know, sometimes we just try to get by and, like, talk to the patient, even if English isn't their first language. And I think definitely patients aren't able to communicate to the doctors exactly what they're feeling and thinking. And I can tell that because sometimes we have patients who are Chinese, and, like, what they communicate in English is, like, pretty much 10% of what they actually can communicate in the language concerning what's going on.
Right.
And so, like, you know, you really, like, for those, like, you would have to get a translator. But even then, it's like the patient doesn't even know how to ask for a translator. So unless the provider actually goes and does this, which they're supposed to do, then the patient will be left silent, especially considering the symptoms.
That's good. Good example. Any others?
They fall into the age category, but sometimes at work, people who have more tenure on the team tend to get their ideas pushed through, or they'll get more interesting opportunities than people who are newer or younger in their careers.
I have a coworker who has two young kids at home and lives in Oakland. She can get to work before 10 a.m. So people will schedule like 8 or 9 meetings, and if they don't like provide a call-in, or you know, they don't work around her schedule, it's really difficult for her to stay involved. And she kind of has to ask people to change their schedule for her, or give a call-in. So it's hard for her to like stay involved when people aren't accommodating.
Yeah, definitely. And it can feel really awkward for her to ask.
Probably, yeah.
So good examples. Anyone else?
I notice vulnerability in youth.
Yeah.
I can say some of his age, but you know, some examples I'm thinking of who are younger, people in Sunday school. But it's just kind of, you know, that intangible quality that some people fit in better than others, or some people don't fit in as well as others. So, you know, like, as a person that is kind of like, has some authority in it, it does feel that I'm a little helpless to do anything about it, because that's the socialization factor that you can only do so much about. Personally, the only thing I think I really can do is, you know, like when you see someone a lot about themselves, just shout them a little bit. And we actually have another interesting situation in which one of you doesn't fit in, but he's very, very vocal. I think that kind of pushes him out. And, you know, it's like you see these dynamics amongst youth. And what's interesting is, I don't think they're really limited to you. I think you see them all the time. It's just more overt, you know?
Mm-hmm.
When people are young, it's like they display those characteristics so much more strongly. I think now we're more kind of passively about that.
And that's good. Paul talked about personalities or even just kind of being aware of social dynamics. That can be part of it, too. That can put people on to be more vulnerable. Okay, so I'm going to turn to Jesus to define the poor for us and the people who are most vulnerable. So I'm going to read from Matthew 25, 32 through 46. Before him will be gathered all the nations, and he will separate people one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he will place the sheep on his right, but the goats on the left. Then the king will say to those on his right, "Come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me." Then the righteous will answer him, saying, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? And when did we see you a stranger and welcome you, or naked and clothe you? And when did we see you sick or in prison and visit you?" And the king will answer them, "Truly I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of these my brothers, you did it to me." All right. So, how does Jesus define the most vulnerable? You guys want to pull it up? Or do you remember? It was Matthew 25, 32 through 46.
Hungry.
Good.
Naked.
Good. Strangers. Thirsty, right?
In prison.
Prisoners. I think one more. Or
sick.
Yeah, sick. Okay, good. I think we got them all. And then, who would be the most vulnerable in these categories? So for gender, the more vulnerable minority would be women. Race.
Such a question.
No. Race is usually people of color. Yeah, especially in America. We're talking mostly in America for these. Ethnicity.
Minority groups.
Minority immigrants. Foreigners. Okay. Sexuality.
LGBT.
And what does that stand for?
Lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans. That was actually queer.
Yeah,
you forgot
to
touch
you. And the A.
Are there more?
Yeah, they've all just put an A on the end to represent everything.
What is the A?
I think it just means everything else.
But that's not.
Breaking down.
No, I mean, all.
Okay.
I may be wrong.
That's good. That's encompassing. Religion.
Scientologists.
They are in the minority, for sure. Muslim.
Jewish.
I think we probably could list most religions. Historically, Christianity is in the majority in America, but I think that could be argued that, you know, evangelical Christians are becoming more of the minority and losing power. So
I think that one we could probably put most religions as a minority. Age.
Old people.
A little bit about this. I think old and young. I think it depends on the situation and who is preferred, I guess. Class, I guess.
Everyone but the top class.
Yeah. And able-bodied would be
not
infirm.
I know for me that are infirm. Okay. So anyone who has people with disabilities, basically. For some of these, they're more fluid, right? Because you're going to change age, and it's possible that you're going to change your health. I guess people can make other decisions about some of these others. But then I also wanted to bring up the vulnerable that you guys listed a while back. I wrote those down. So that was domestic violence, and sexual assault survivors, the oppressed.
Bless you.
Slaves, immigrants, and children, and grad students. Okay. So these are the poor. These are the people that are, you know, most vulnerable in our society. Poor grad students.
Students aren't the minority, though.
It's true. That's a good point. Like, majority and minority can shift based on specific situations or rooms, but we want to think about, like, cultural majority and those people usually have more power. So even if it's like the only man in a room of women, they still have inherent power that is given to them by society. So it's a helpful tool. Clearly, some of these are overlapped, and some people are going to be in specific roles that give them a lot more authority than others. So obviously, like a woman who's the CEO, she's going to have more power. But these are helpful categories to be thinking, you know, who has more power within institutions and society. So obviously, Jesus calls us to care for the poor, and he talks about that as an act of worship. We're not earning our salvation by caring for the poor, but God calls us to love the vulnerable. And to care for the poor out of our love for God, right? As if we were loving Jesus himself. And I'll just read James 1:27. A religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this: to look after orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world. So clearly, caring for the vulnerable is central to our faith. And I'll give you one more example of poor in our society. And I am going to read. All right, there we go. And he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you."
So we are called to be poor in spirit. So the Greek word for poor in the Beatitudes is actually means powerless. So we're called to recognize our own sin and spiritual poverty and realize that we are poor without God. Without God, we are spiritually poor. And as Christians, we recognize our poverty, and we mourn, and we are meek, and we are hungry and thirsty and merciful and are persecuted. And all those are acts of vulnerability. And we're called to allow ourselves to be vulnerable. In fact, we're called to be the last, the slaves, the servants. And we're called to be in this position of vulnerability so that we can empathize with those who are poor and so that we can serve them well. Okay, so now we need to think about how do we apply the power that we have. So we see power in society, we recognize who is most vulnerable in our society, and so how can we create new culture, create new roles and rules, and distribute power? So institutions at their best use their power to distribute power. So I'll actually read an excerpt as an illustration of distributing power. This comes from Sheryl Sandberg's book, Lean In. Sheryl Sandberg is the chief operating officer of Facebook, and this was her introduction to her book, Lean In. And she talks about when she was pregnant and also running the online sales and operations group at Google at the time. One day, after a rough morning spent staring at the bottom of the toilet, I had to rush to make an important client meeting. Google was growing so quickly that parking was an ongoing problem, and the only spot I could find was quite far away. I sprinted across the parking lot, which in reality meant lumbering in a bit more quickly than my absurdly slow pregnancy crawl. This only made my nausea worse, and I arrived at the meeting praying that a sales pitch was the only thing that would come out of my mouth. That night, I recounted these troubles to my husband, Dave. He pointed out that Yahoo, where he worked at the time, had designated parking for expectant mothers at the front of each building. The next day, I marched in, or more like waddled in, to see Google founders Larry Page and Sergey Brin in their office, which was really just a large room with toys and gadgets strewn all over the floor. I found Sergey in a yoga position in the corner and announced, We need pregnancy parking, preferably sooner rather than later. He looked up at me and agreed immediately, noting that he'd never thought about it before. To this day, I'm embarrassed that I didn't realize that pregnant women needed reserved parking until I experienced my own aching feet. As one of Google's most senior women, didn't I have a responsibility to think of this? But like Sergey, it had never occurred to me. The other pregnant women must have suffered in silence, not wanting to ask for special treatment, or maybe they lacked the confidence or seniority to demand that the problem be fixed. Having one pregnant woman at the top, even one who looked like a whale, made a difference. And those parking spots are still there. Every new Google building has expectant mother parking spots. So I think that's a great example where Sheryl just used her power to care for those in need, right? She recognized someone else recognized people in need, and she was able to use her position to change something to care for those who had specific needs. So we're called to bring the interests of the underrepresented to the attention of those in power, to governments, to churches, to the general public. And a few ways we can do that is make decisions at work, or vote, or donate to charities, or volunteer. And then as individuals, you know, we can think about what our role is to be advocates for the poor in these institutions, and how can we use our individual roles or our individual privilege to care for the poor, or care for the most vulnerable that surround us. So thinking back to my work at FMSC, Feed My Starving Children, I rather call it FMSC, then I was, I guess, pretty disappointed that I couldn't find a full-time work in what I thought I was most passionate about. And I thought that meant caring for the poor. And I thought the only way to do that was to work at a nonprofit full-time. And when after a year of like looking for work and not being able to find full-time work, God basically handed me on a silver platter a job at Google. And I still don't know why he did that, but it really, you know, has made me question, like, why did God give me a job in arguably one of the most powerful companies in the world, right? When I thought that I wanted to work in a nonprofit. And so for the past couple of years, I've been trying to find pockets within Google where they care for the poor, where they like partner with nonprofits or write grants. I applied to a couple jobs in those departments. They're super competitive and really small. And I thought that was maybe what God wanted for me, was to find that niche within Google where they actually are visibly caring for the poor. And when none of those worked out, I was talking to a friend actually a couple weeks ago, and she was starting this women in tech basically organization, and she was talking about how she was hoping to do it full time, and I was starting to get a little jealous, and I was like, wow, maybe I should be looking to do something like that, or maybe I should start looking for jobs like that, because that's what I used to be passionate about, and maybe I've lost part of that passion, or maybe I don't care about the poor anymore. And I realized that I actually really like my job, and I don't want to run away from it, and I don't think I'm called to one of those jobs, at least not right now. And I used to think that I needed that institutional leadership. We actually talked about that a couple of weeks ago, the difference between institutional and personal leadership. And I thought that I wanted to be kind of in the front and leading a movement. And then I thought about Paul, actually, as our pastor, and realized we're not all called to be pastors. I mean, Paul is a great leader for us and someone who encourages us, but we're all called to be the church, and we're on the front lines caring for people and loving people, and that's just as important, right? And so I recognize that, you know, God has me in my job to be a leader, personally, right, and use my power within my role to care for the vulnerable. And the vulnerable in the Silicon Valley look a lot different than I thought they did, or they don't look like starving children, or it's not as obvious, right? But one day I was kind of hanging out late after work, and a few of my coworkers were chatting about some conversations they had with their clients, and it turned out a couple of my Black coworkers had some of their clients that were pretty racist to them over the phone. So some of my Black coworkers, who my coworker Lanesha, for example, she, like, her client didn't want to work with her, knowing her name and assuming her race, and actually requested to be paired with someone else who would work with them. And she actually had to say, no, you're going to work with me because I'm here to support your account, and I'm the person who, you know, is going to be most helpful for you. And that was something that I will never experience. I didn't even know it happened. I expect clients to be overtly racist over the phone, right? Or refuse service from somebody at Google who's offering to help them just because of their race. And I think that was a good experience for me to say, like, hey, I got the opportunity to just listen to some of my coworkers who have particular needs. And they have less power in society for a number of reasons based on its own history. You know, we won't go into why, but the fact that I could listen to their needs and be an advocate for them and tell them, you know, like, hey, that's messed up, and now I'm going to be more aware of those type of comments or attitudes from my clients, and just think about how I can be an advocate for them, right? The other way to think about our personal power is resources. So power has a lot to do with just having resources or access to resources. And resources can be a number of things. It can be money. It could be clothes, food, water. But it also could be time, knowledge, connections you have. It could even be like mileage points if you want to donate mileage points or give somebody a free flight. I mean, think about the resources you have. Could be job coaching or even just like knowing how to write a resume. I mean, some people, that's power in our society, right? And some people don't know how to do that. So thinking about what resources you have and who is most vulnerable in your life and how can you share your resources as well as your privileges. And ultimately, you know, I've kind of been talking about these quadrants, but you guys are pretty familiar with that. But we talked about the poor being down here, and this is where God wants us to be, acting or exercising our power with authority and vulnerability. And so ultimately, we want to bring the poor here so that they can be image bearers, act the way God desired them or created them so that they can fulfill their role as an image bearer of God using power with authority and vulnerability. So yeah, I think I'll just end with posing the question, you know, who is poor in your life and how can you use your institutional power and personal power to empower the vulnerable? And I'll leave you guys with a verse. Proverbs 31, 8 through 9. Speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves, for the rights of all who are destitute. Speak up and judge fairly. Defend the rights of the poor and needy.